The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm very pleased to see so many of you here this evening. Tonight, we're going to turn back the clock to the beginning of the millennium to explore the intersection through fiction of the personal with the political, technological, and religious strains running through the culture at the time. And by that time, I mean our own. With his 10th novel, Thomas Mallon's creative arc now spans three centuries of plots that take us from W back to Abraham Lincoln. His acclaimed books include Watergate, Finale, Henry and Clara, and Fellow Travelers, which was adapted into a popular opera. For his work, he has earned Guggenheim and Rockefeller Fellowships, as well as the National Book Critics Circle Award for reviewing. His new novel, Landfall, is a fictionalized account of the stormy George W. Bush years between 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina. A reviewer in the Wall Street Journal writes, "As in Mr. Mallon's many other novels, the writing is crisp and witty, the central characters complex and sympathetic in surprising ways, the narrative structure tight. Mallon has a gift for convincingly emulating the voice and thoughts of his characters, both fictional and real." Nathan Englander's talents have also been widely praised. Washington Post book editor Ron Charles calls Englander's third novel, Kaddish.com, a tragicomic treatment of death, guilt, and Jewish orthodoxy, which surely pays homage to the late great writer Philip Roth. What a rare blessing to find a smart and witty novel about the unexpected ways religious commitment can fracture a life and restore it. Englander is also the author of the story collections For the Relief of Unbearable Urges and What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, a Pulitzer Prize finalist and winner of the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award. In addition to his widely anthologized fiction, he is the author of the novels The Ministry of Special Cases and Dinner at the Center of the Earth. It's a pleasure to have both writers return. Please welcome our first presenter, Nathan Englander.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out. It's great to be back here, and I'm writing faster now, so I'm really just back here. There's usually a decade goes by in between, and you get to watch me age in a shocking jumps. But yeah, I was just here last year, and thank you for that generous and kindly introduction. And I'm pointing at Thomas Mallon, but I'm super excited about the pairing tonight. That's fun for me. Last time I was here, I talked and talked. Hi, Harold. This is like a, I don't know, I haven't read in a while. We used to read at readings, so I think I want to read the first chapter of this book because it's a fun one for me. To set it up, we're going to talk after. I mean, this book is Kaddish.com. You hear the name. It's about God and technology and faith and ideas of home and guilt and redemption and about 5 million things around that. But I can tell you what the start of it, there's usually, I call it like executing the inexecutable. There's kind of a jokey, I love like feeling empathy for a joke. You know, that's sort of how I started my career. Like, I used to have long, long hair, you know, crazy big hair, and I'd go to my sister's very religious for Shabbat dinner, and her friends would be like, I can make a wig out of that hair. You know what I'm saying? It's just a punchline. But then I thought of like a Hasidic woman who's desperate to buy this man's hair. You know what I'm saying? Like, I thought about like an empathetic treatment of a Jewish Santa Claus. Like, there's these, by the way, in the last 20 years, it's 20 years almost to the day, I've met every Jewish Santa Claus in America at this point. They are legion, more than you think. But on this note, I'm... it was actually I think it was on this stage with Foer when we were doing the Haggadah here. I've done all my book. I love coming here. I love this podium. But we were on this stage, and I would read like I'd get introduced as like an atheist and radically secular, and then I'd read from the Haggadah, and he'd say like vaudevillians, have you ever seen a more religious man in your life? You know, I get teased about that infinitely. My wife, literally, like, I'll eat, you know, a cheeseburger on Yom Kippur, but she will, you know, come home and find me like tithing because it's a harvest year. She'll be like, I saw that weird, obscure thing that you're doing. Anyway, I got really interested in journeys and the journeys we take. You know what I'm saying? We support people. If somebody stopped drinking and they're on their wagon, you're like, you know, keep going, keep at it. If someone becomes religious, that's their journey. If they become secular, that's their journey. But I'm really interested in doublings, and I thought about the flip back. Like, everyone teases me about my religious soul. And I thought, I grew up religious, I'm secular. How weird would it be to just one day flip? And I think that's the real, you know, again, we'll talk about the serious stuff, guilt and mourning and all that. But the real core of it is that idea of, like, what's in our souls. Anyway, I'll read for a few minutes. 14 minutes, I don't know. Kaddish.com. Mirrors covered in front door ajar, collar torn and sporting a shadow of beard. Larry leans against the granite top of his sister's fancy kitchen island. He says, everyone's staring at me, all of your friends. That's what people do, Dina tells him. They come, they say kind things, they feel uncomfortable and they stare. It's only hours after the funeral, and honestly, Larry hates himself for bringing it up. He really thought nothing could add to the despair of his father's loss, but this quiet, muttering stream of well-wishers has made it for Larry all the worse. What he's taking issue with is the look that he's getting. It's not the usual pain nod one naturally offers. Larry's convinced there's a bite to it, condemning. He doesn't know how he'll survive a week trapped in his sister's home, in his sister's community, when every time one of the visitors glances over, Larry feels himself appraised. And so he keeps raising his hand to the top of his head, checking for the yarmulke sitting there like a hubcap for all its emotional weight. In its absence, at his own father Shiva would be the same as standing naked before them. Sneaked off into the kitchen with his sister, their first moment alone, Larry unloads his complaints in a hiss. Tell them, he says, to stop looking my way. At a condolence call, you want them not to look at the... Dina pauses. What are we? The condoled? The aggrieved? We are the grievances. The mourner, she says. You want them not to show that they care. I want them not to judge me just because I left their stupid world. Dina laughs, her first since they put their father into the ground. This is so like you, his sister tells him. To make it negative, to complicate what can't be any more simple. This bitterness in the face of what is pure niceness is on you. On me? Are you kidding? Are you really saying that today? You know that I am, little brother. I love you, Larry. But if you choose, even yes today, to throw one of your fits, my fits? Don't yell, Larry. People can hear. Fuck the people. Oh, that's nice. I mean it, Larry says, thinking that fit may not be a completely inappropriate word. Go on, then. Curse at the terrible people who will cook for us and feed us and drive carpool for me all week and make sure that we don't mourn alone. Yes, curse at the nice men who washed our father's body and prepared the shroud and laid the shards atop his eyes and now come to make a minion in this house. Spare me, Dina. It's my mourning, too, and I should get to feel at home in your home as much as them. Who's saying different? But you have to understand, they aren't used to it, Larry, used to what you do. Dina takes a breath, reorganizing her thoughts. Memphis Jews are even more conservative than the ones we grew up with. In Brooklyn, even the edgeless have an edge. Here, if you're going to be radical, people may, a little bit, stare. Larry's now the one staring. He stands before his older sister, giving her the best of his blank looks. About what he was doing that anyone could think radical, Larry had no clue. Tell me you don't know, she says. Honestly, tell me it's not on purpose that you've actually forgotten so much. Honestly, I don't, I. And here Larry was going to swear, which Orthodox Jews are forbidden to do. In deference not so much to his sister, but to the opportunity to prove his innocence, that he is not as odd a duck as they think him, that he isn't doing anything anyone can consider wrong, Larry writes his sentence and, with a stutter, ends it on the word promise. I promise, he says. You really need me to tell you? I do. Dina rolls her eyes as she has since Larry was old enough to understand what it meant and likely before. She explains what she's sure he knows and is without a doubt doing on purpose. You step out into the yard. You read a book, she says with true sisterly fury. You sit like it's nothing on a regular chair. Larry straightens up at that, pushing with his hands against the counter, stepping back into the radius of his offense. He gives himself a moment, letting the blood flow to his cheeks, his face reddening as if like a chameleon he can change color at will. It's no reason to treat me like a freak, he says. They're just stupid rules. But even as he says it, religious little brother that he is, black sheep and yes, apostate, Larry understands that for Dina, there's so much more than that. For him to step out of the house, to read a page for pleasure, and above all, to reject that special Shiva perch, the low chair, the wooden box, a couch with the cushions removed, it is too much. That ancient pose, the mourner sitting slope-shouldered, ashen-faced, and close to the ground, it represents for Dina pure sorrow. A stupid chair isn't what makes it mourning, Larry says, doubling down, though he knows for his sister a chair absolutely did. There lies Larry wedged in his nephew's narrow bed, in his nephew's narrow room, freezing under a thin polyester comforter in Dina's arctically over-air-conditioned house. Sleep does not come on the first night of mourning when Larry, mustering all his Zazen-based mindfulness, cannot disengage from the shock of his own thoughts. He wants to scream daddy, and he wants to scream mommy, and it's that pure regression on top of the grief that has him so alarmed, a grown man frustrated with his frustration, wrestling to keep his hurt pent up. If Larry wasn't already headed there on his own, Dina had nudged him the rest of the way back to childhood by sticking him in an 11-year-old's lair instead of settling her 30-year-old brother in the more uncle-worthy den. But the den is where their father had taken sick during his Passover visit. It's where he'd convalesced between the many trips to the hospital until his final fateful admittance. That room was blocked off in Dina's mind. And so this skinny bed for Larry, on which he flips to face the glow of his nephew's aquarium. Its watery light bathes him while illuminating the wall opposite, the fish gliding before a shelf of giant trophies, the likes of which Larry, in his sporting years, had never won. And now he does not want to yell for his parents, but yell at his sister, furious over what he couldn't exactly say. Maybe it's the light of the tank turned blinding, keeping a sleepless man awake. Maybe it's because in their already tiny family, his big sister hadn't been able to make their father not die. Or because when he was his nephew's tender age, Dina, older, wiser, hadn't been able to stop their flaky mother from running off to Marin County with Dennis, her ridiculous new age husband. The newlyweds fresh from a marriage that took place the very day their dear father held the get in his hands. Their mother had literally gone from her divorce in rabbinical court straight to a chuppah in Prospect Park. She'd forced Larry to hold one of the supporting poles while Dennis broke the glass, stomping it with his fat Birkenstocked foot. Larry shakes his head at the memory and pressing a pillow over his face until he sees stars. He figures he's maybe mad at Dina simply for representing all that was left of the only family he'd ever known. Now it was the two of them, alone. Except Dina is not alone. She has her husband and her three kids and the hundreds of religious clanspeople who'd pour in all week. These southern Memphis Gracelandian Jews who'd never give up or go away. Larry, overcome with exhaustion and emotion with the endless exploration of his sorrows, gives up and crawls from bed. He yanks the fish tank's plug from the wall with a force edging on violence and sighs with relief as a restorative darkness floods the room. Feeling his way back under the boy's blanket, tucking himself in, Larry floats towards sleep in that wonderful blackness. But he can't let go. Haunted as he is by thoughts of death and of dirt, of gravel thrumming against coffin, and the literal specter of a soul formerly separated from its body, his father's ghost on the loose. With Larry's own body stretched out in that narrow casket of a bed and chock full of superstition, it's as if he dug up his old religious self just as his father was buried. Eyes closed, he tries again and again to let himself drift, but his ears train themselves on the fish in the tank, concerned with their well-being. More and more, Larry worries that by pulling the plug, he turned off the whole contraption, that he'd somehow suffocate the fish or undrown them or whatever the term is for stopping things that breathe underwater from doing whatever it is that they do. He can't quite obviously hear them swimming, so he instead tried to isolate the sound of the water filter, separating it from the unfamiliar electrical hum of the house. But everything is overpowered by the drone of whatever tireless compressor is anchored nearby and forcing all that icy air through the vent above his bed. So Larry opens his eyes again, stirring further and strains his vision against the darkness, hoping to make out the smokestack of bubbles rising from that stupid aquarium's pump. He is, and he knows it's not rational, fully terrified that the family will wake to another set of funerals, all of them his idiot avuncular fault. He pictures them all crunched into the bathroom in their funereal clothing, now poised over one of the house's stately, silent flush, rich person toilets. Larry's nephew will preside while his two nieces, like pallbearers, hold a fish-heavy skimmer, the kids watching those murder charges tumble off to their maker, just as they had with their grandfather the morning before. Every time sleep comes, the fish pull Larry back until he drags himself from bed to plug the damn thing back in. With the light burning, Larry gives himself over to the endlessness of the night, lying there missing his father, loving his father, who, white-bearded and full of faith, had been the only one from Larry's old life, from their cloistered community, who saw his true nature, loving Larry for exactly who he was and cherishing the man he'd become. "I want you to know," his father had said from his hospital bed, "that you, in this world and the next, will be fine." "You think?" Larry had said. "Do you know what I think? I'm asking. I think the world to come is just a long table where everyone on both sides sits, men and women." "Pets?" "No pets," his father said. "None?" "Fine," his father said. "Under the table, the dogs and cats, but no birds. I can't picture it with birds." "Fair enough," Larry said. This long table with its perfect white cloth is set not with food and drink, but with the Torah, copies for everyone so that you can read to yourself or learn in pairs. I can picture that. And you know what happens at this table? What? All you do for eternity is study, nothing else. No interruption, no day, no night, no weekend or holiday, no Yimei Chag or Chol. For it is the afterlife, time unbroken, all of it given over to one purpose. "Sure," Larry said. "This is why, for the souls gathered, this single place serves as both heaven and hell." Here his father had gulped at the air, fish-like himself. "It goes like this," his father said. "If you have a good mind and a good heart, if you like to learn Torah and take interest in knowledge, then studying for eternity is, for you, heaven." He had looked to his son, and Larry had nodded. "And if all you want is to waste time on narishkeit and bunk stuff, to think your greedy thoughts though the money is gone, and to think your dirty thoughts though your schwanz is buried down below, then for you that same table is torture. Then sitting there with your bad brain, you find yourself in hell." Larry considered the idea poised at his father's side. Partly he thought it was funny and thought about making a Larry-like joke. But being his father's son, Larry also took it seriously. He was awed at the notion and somehow afraid. His father, who could read him like no one else, reached out with his liver-spotted hand and, laying it atop Larry, said, "I'm sure in that place for you it would be heaven." Larry had gasped, not from surprise, but choking back the rush of comfort he took in his father's ruling. "Trust me, Larry. It's all right that you don't believe. This period in your life, it feels like forever. But if you're lucky, life is long, and each of these forevers will one day seem fleeting. You think when I was your age that I could have pictured this? That it would be 1999, the edge of a new millennium, and I'd be saying goodbye to a handsome grown son at the end of my days? I can tell you that even back then, I already felt old and thought I knew it all." His father gave a weak squeeze to Larry's hand. "You're a good boy, and I pray that I don't see you across from me until you reach 120 years. But for you, my boy chick, when it's the right time to take your seat, that table will feel like a blessing without end. Thanks."
Hi, thanks for coming. It's very nice of Andy and the Free Library to have me back, and it's a delight to be able to read with Nathan tonight. I'm just going to talk for a little bit, and then I'm going to end by reading a very short scene from this new novel of mine, Landfall, which is the last volume in a trilogy that I didn't know was going to be a trilogy. Had I known that when I started out, I wouldn't have had the middle volume called Finale, which my editor assured me would just be a problem for the marketers. I've accidentally become sort of the bard of Republican catastrophe in fiction. I started out about 10 years ago, I started a novel about the Watergate scandal, just called Watergate. And then that was followed by a novel called Finale, which was about the Reagan presidency during 1986, which was arguably its lowest point. Iran-Contra's beginning, Democrats are taking back the Senate, a whole host of domestic ills the president is not well equipped to deal with, from homelessness to AIDS, and what at the time seemed the fiasco of the Reykjavik summit. In the fullness of time, it looked better, but at the time, it just seemed like a catastrophe. And this new book has the president, George W. Bush, living through 2005, 2006, the worst years of the Iraq insurgency and Hurricane Katrina, which in his own memoirs, Bush says, was essentially the end of his presidency. It was such a catastrophe of mismanagement. The books have a lot in common. They're all about on the same scale. They have large casts of characters, predominantly actual real-life figures, but also some crucial fictional figures as well. And they take pretty much the same approach. They show an essential fidelity to the public record. I don't really write alternate history fiction, you know, that sort of genre fiction where the South wins the Civil War, things like that happen. I try to show not what happened instead, the way alternate history does, but what might have happened in addition to what we know, what might have happened behind the scenes, what might have happened in between the cracks. I think the duty of the historical novelist is to research the facts with, one hopes, the diligence of an actual historian or a biographer, and then, having gathered the facts, to treat them with a degree of irresponsibility that will allow either for entertainment or speculation of a different kind of psychological avenue into some of the people who make history. I mean, one example from this new book, I think it has been discussed in every review of the book, there's a sex scene involving Condi Rice, the president's secretary of state. She is sleeping about two-thirds of the way through the book with the Canadian foreign minister, with whom she was very friendly and who was very handsome, kind of her type, an ex-jock, and so forth. They got along quite well. And the idea for this scene came when she visited Nova Scotia and his hometown on the fifth anniversary of 9/11. And thanked the people of Halifax for taking in the diverted planes on 9/11. This is the musical in New York that's been made from this Come From Away. And he took her to dinner with his parents that night, and they spent the night in a lodge in his hometown. And the next morning they did a press event, and he was asked about his growing acquaintance with Secretary Rice, and he said, "Oh, I've learned so much more about her on this trip than I knew from our previous meetings and official interactions." And they said, "Well, what have you learned?" And the first thing he cited was, "Well, I've learned she likes to sleep with the window open." And it caused sort of mild startlement among the reporters. And if you're a historian, you sort of have to stop there. There's really nothing much you can do in the absence of further evidence. But if you're a novelist and don't go any further with that, something's really quite wrong with you. While similar to these other two volumes, there were also differences that made it a very different experience writing for me this time. For one thing, there was the sheer recency of the events. Iraq, Katrina. I mean, it's still almost the news. It scarcely can be called history yet. We're only going back about, you know, a dozen years or so in this. And that made for a difference in perspective, a different feeling when dealing with the material. Most of the people when I was writing about Watergate or even the Reagan years, most of the principal figures were dead or they had long since quit the scene. In the case of the Bush administration, most of the key players are still alive. Many of them are still active in one way or another. The other thing that was different for me, which showed up principally in the two main fictional characters in this book, one who is a man named Ross Weatherall, who works for the Arts Endowments, and another is an Army lawyer named Allison O'Connor. One of the things that was different for me as I created them was I was able this time, able or condemned, it felt like one or the other at different moments, to endow them with some of my own experience. Because the chief difference in writing this novel was, however peripherally, I was involved in some of these events. I was in the most outer orbit of the administration, the most Plutonian outer darkness, the least consequential position you can imagine. I was the deputy chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities for a while and had been on the NEH Council. So I was hardly in a position to be in any kind of meeting that I would be writing about in this book. But I was around. I knew people who were in meetings like this. I went to parties at the White House. I got to know people. And so in the course of this job, I even had to go to Afghanistan briefly. I had to go to New Orleans briefly to administer emergency grants for libraries and museums. Mostly we were trying to keep mold off of manuscripts, paintings, and so forth. And that was a very different kind of experience to have to bring to bear on the book. And I offloaded that mostly on to these fictional characters and made use of it. It was a very strange experience to be writing a historical novel and to actually, as one of my sources, use my own diaries. I had kept a diary the time I was in Afghanistan and to go back and to write about some of those incidents. There were downsides as well about being, if not close by, nearby to things that were going on. In all of these three books in this accidental trilogy, the First Lady is a principal character. Mrs. Nixon is a main character in the Watergate book. Nancy Reagan is one of the principal characters in Finale. I didn't quite know what to do in this book because, for one thing, in the course of doing that job at the NEH, I had gotten to know Mrs. Bush slightly. We worked with her office. She was very good to the endowments, had protected their funding, kept away their chief antagonists in the Republican Party who were eager to reignite the culture wars, like Mike Pence in the House of Representatives, who hadn't gotten the memo that we were really not interested in having another Mapplethorpe imbroglio or something like that. And I knew her just well enough. She had read a couple of my books. She had plugged them one night on Larry King Live. I knew her just well enough to feel uncomfortable writing about her, so I thought, what am I going to do here? And I thought, this is the rare instance where you have a president who also had a mother who was First Lady. So a lot of the First Lady duties in this book got offloaded onto Barbara Bush, who's this kind of one-woman witch's chorus as the novel goes. She's sort of, in many ways, more like the Alice Roosevelt Longworth character in Watergate. So it was a somewhat different experience to be writing about these events that I felt I had seen in some ways, even though the book involved a lot of the kind of standard research I had done for the other ones. And I just thought to, as an example of a very short scene that shows this blend of actuality and pure fiction, I would read a very brief scene which is supposed to take place on September 14, 2006. shortly after the Condi Rice sex scene, which had taken place about 3 days before. And this is an imaginary conversation between President Bush and my dear, much lamented, daily missed friend, Christopher Hitchens, in Washington. There is nobody I would want to have more on the scene today than Christopher. I mean, in some ways, it's one of God's mercies that he didn't live to see the last 3 years, but one can only imagine. And Christopher was in a very unique position in the first decade of the century. He was, aside from the giver of the most entertaining parties in Washington, where you would meet people of every conceivable ideology, there were these extraordinary mashups that you would meet. You would find yourself sitting between some ex-governor and Donatella Versace, you know, and you would be trying to make conversation with them. And but aside from being in the thick of things, Christopher was famously in that decade an apostate about the Iraq War. He was a very committed man of the left, remained a committed man of the left until he died. But on this issue, he was very conspicuously out of line with people that he generally did line up with politically. It brought him a lot of grief, and much more to Christopher's taste, it brought him a lot of combat. It brought him a tremendous amount of controversy, debate. Christopher's one of the first writers I can think of who has left a gigantic YouTube archive. If you miss Christopher the way I do, you can watch him and listen to him by the hour. You can watch him debate the existence of God with a Washington rabbi and hear the rabbi say to him, Mr. Hitchens, I didn't interrupt you. And then Christopher turns to the rabbi and says, you're not quick enough. Because Christopher was in favor of the Iraq War, and quite full-throatedly in favor of it, there were many people in the administration, as you can imagine, who were delighted to have this blue-chip British intellectual unexpectedly on their side. And they were trying to play this up and make him a more conspicuous supporter than he was comfortable being. There were many people who wanted to get him together with George W. Bush. To my knowledge, such a meeting never took place, but I imagine one happening very briefly, and what it might have been. It's sort of like one of those old Max Beerbohm cartoons of, you know, literary meetings that never happened but might have. So this takes place on September 14th, 06. I think the only thing you need to know beyond anything I've said is that Karen Keller, who's mentioned here, is the president's secretary in the outer office. The president had been up on the Hill for a meeting with House Republicans and then come back here for a one-on-one with Ro, the South Korean guy, whose nuke nerves were growing and who had no idea there was an elephant in the room, the proposal he'd made to Putin in St. Petersburg 2 months ago. There was no point in springing that on the guy until an answer came from Russia. During the next couple of weeks, he'd have Musharraf and Karzai coming in here. In between them, there'd be Rush Week at the UN, requiring his annual acceptance of the global cold shoulder. And before he could even have lunch today, there was a quick meeting on the schedule with this Hitchens character, something he'd long resisted despite the guy's unexpected support on Iraq. He'd finally given in to persistent nudges from Rove and the NEH chairman, whose name he never could remember. He remained wary of welcoming this loose cannon, who supposedly had a bug up his ass about even Mother Teresa. But here was Karen Keller bringing him in, no tie, along with two folders of stuff for signatures. Bush looked out over his half glasses and stood up to shake hands. This had been arranged as an off-the-record conversation, not an interview, so he was glad to see no pad or tape recorder on the man. I've appreciated your support, he told the writer. I hear you're a complex, contradictory fella. Actually, I'm a seamless garment of truth. Happy to support you when I can, eager to oppose you when I must. I don't suppose I can convince you to sack Karen Hughes. Bush pursed his presidential lips and shot him a "that's not funny" look. Hitchens, having sat down without being asked to, pointed to the folders Mrs. Keller had brought and asked, "Anything interesting?" Bush laughed. "First item's a little sad, a statement on Ann Richards' passing. She once called you a jerk. Thanks for the reminder. The other one? An annual, like one of my mother's flowers." Bush turned the document so that it faced Hitchens. The president's yearly proclamation of Constitution Week was being issued, quote, "in accordance with the Joint Congressional Resolution of August 2, 1956, 36 United States Code 108, as amended," unquote. "What's your favorite within the first?" asked Hitchens. "First Amendment, that is. Which particular freedom?" Bush gave him a smile that said, "Nice try." "I'm relatively fresh from studying the whole document for my citizenship test." "Good man," said the president. "Have you had your ceremony?" "No, I took the test on the 6th of June and I'm still waiting." "Sorry things are slow. INS is a little preoccupied." "One would think they'd be quicker signing up allies ready to pledge fealty, on D-Day no less. But Chertoff promises to swear me in himself when the time arrives." Bush wasn't surprised that this guy knew the head of Homeland Security. "Rove tells me that you get around." The architect had also told him that the man was a prodigious drinker. "My own personal preference, going back to the First Amendment," said Hitchens, "would be the lead item on the list. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion." Bush just nodded. "Here comes the Mother Teresa shit," he thought. "I've been wondering about these three Republican congressmen who are threatening to hold up your defense appropriation bill unless the military's chaplains are allowed to invoke Jesus' name a bit more specifically than they are at present." "I take it you have an objection to their reform proposal." "What I have," said Hitchens, "is a better idea. Eliminate the chaplains entirely." "Madison was quite pointedly against having them, either in the foxhole or at the congressional rostrum. You know there's a war on, something of which those three House members trying to give Jesus pride of place might well be reminded. And I'm trying, have been for 5 years, to keep it from being one religion at war with another. You've been forced to make war on the one religion most bent on making the government and religion indistinguishable. The further we stay away from doing that, the mightier and worthier a foe we shall be." He couldn't get him out of here soon enough. "Christmas will be coming along in a few months. We'll have a little manger and some Hanukkah candles upstairs. That too much for you? Got a problem with that?" "A considerable one. The ecumenical is still theistic and thus an unjust imposition on many citizens, including some future ones." Rove was going to pay for this. Thank you.
All right, perfect. Thank you very much for those very entertaining readings. Very spirited. Would somebody like to start us off with a question? If so, just raise your hand and we will get a microphone to you.
That's without even the traditional pause. That was good.
Thank you. I enjoyed the book, Landfall. In the middle, I don't know where it is, in the middle of the book, President Bush is talking with Senator Dole, former Senator Dole. And Senator Dole says to him, they're talking about the Iraq War, and he says, "Get yourself a general." Where does that come from? I'm just curious. I mean,
that's another bit of irresponsibility. That conversation never took place. But the book sort of ends with the surge. I mean, you know, Bush really felt after Katrina that the only thing he could really do with his presidency is try to salvage something from Iraq. And so the general, obviously, in the future that Dole somehow seems to have in mind, you know, is David Petraeus. But that came out of mostly my own impressions of Dole. I had profiled him once in the New York Times Magazine and spent a fair amount of time with him. And so I felt sort of, I knew, presumptuously, I knew something about his habits of mind and, you know, way of talking and so forth. So it was natural to sort of fit him in the book. The other thing was that he actively disliked Bush's father, 41. I mean, they had had a really contentious history. And so that played into my desire to put him in the book as well.
Nathan, have you had to dance around a historical character or amplify them or fill the interstices that
way? That's good. Now I don't have to wait my turn because I had a question. So now I'll jump in. I'll answer and then ask, but I saw your hand. Oh, yeah, it happens with me. I mean, the last book, my Dinner at the Center of the Earth, that I was here for isn't like my exploration of Israel-Palestine. I mean, in that one, literally one of the main characters I called the general, and I didn't call him Sharon. Like, you know, in that book, Arafat is Arafat, and you know, Olmert is Olmert. Everybody is themselves except for the general, because I thought, I want people to reflect, like to test values in this book, and Sharon is so explosive. Like, the people who love him for his wars and the many times he saved Israel and all his successful battles, and the people who hate him for the exact same thing, for turning away to Sabra and Shatila and the Kibya massacre. Like, you know, I just thought you can't even read them, like, so he like went through the looking glass for me and just became someone else. But that's what I was thinking, especially hearing your reading. Like, there's different, the bubble, writers need to know other people, just even the NEH stuff. It's so good to meet other people. Writers used to talk to, painters can't only talk to painters. It's good for your brain. But anyway, but I know so many writers and I can hear from the reading, like, your musculature changes, like you become Bush, you know? Like, there's a different kind of mimicry that some people do that I can hear in your stuff. But that's what I want to interest, because a lot of my stuff is historical and I do have the characters and I don't get to talk about it that much, but I'd love to hear, because, like, I know there's this weird metaphysical space where there's the historical record and then there's this way where they become where we can know why that window is open. So yeah, I'm wondering what happens when you are dealing with the real people, like you said, why you wouldn't, you know, touch one, that sounds weird, not one, use one first lady, but I guess I want to know what happens in your brain when you're, you know, what that feels like.
I guess, I mean, in these books, I've never really been tempted to, you know, refract the characters into somebody who would be recognizable, but, you know, would also give me a certain level of deniability, you know, was there under a different name and had a slightly different political resume and so forth. I mean, it just never, I mean, I think probably I don't have the gifts to do it. And I just think if my sort of project is to present as realistic a texture of history as possible. I mean, I need the main actors there. Other writers will decide this very differently. I'm writing a thing for The New Yorker now about these books about the 60s and 70s that younger writers have been writing. There's a fellow named Jonathan First who's just written a book that's about to come out. And clearly the main character is based on Abbie Hoffman and went back to writers of his generation, like Susan Choi, her book American Woman, where the characters are all very clearly identifiable as figures in the Patty Hearst kidnapping and so forth. But in both of those books, and in almost all the books I've been looking at in this piece, the writer doesn't cross that last threshold where they actually put the actual person in. They put this refraction of the men. It may give them more imaginative freedom to diverge from bits and pieces of the actual historical narrative. So in that sense, it may be liberating to them. But it's not, for all the, you know, indecision you have in writing any novel, I don't think that I ever had any hesitation about that. I always knew that everybody was going to go in under their own name. In the books, and if you're writing about this kind of politics, they're at such a mega level of fame. I mean, if you're dealing with Arafat and people like that, that there's no question. You know, people would say to me, "How could you have written certain things about Mrs. Nixon? You know, she has living children, and it was actually a warm depiction of Mrs. Nixon. But you know, there you imagine certain things for her, and you know, my thought was if this is the worst that Julie and Tricia ever have to cope with, you know?
Yes.
So if you were dealing with obscure figures, people who were, say, on the borderline between between being public figures and private figures, I might be more hesitant.
Yes. People know, there's that nonfiction guy, and I who got in trouble for the Dylan book. And it was, and I was like, because it's so Jewish. It was a Jewish guy from Tablet, a Jewish reporter. When he made up his quotes, and I just love that someone said Bob Dylan never said that. And he's like, yeah, he's like, yeah. I love that there's someone who knows everything Bob Dylan ever said. You know, he never said that.
Mr. Mallon, would you consider expanding your trilogy and having a fourth book that might deal with the current occupant? I have a feeling there's a lot of material there, and you could call it Finale 2.
My only answer I will take from King Lear. Never, 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 never. I actually wrote a thing again in The New Yorker a couple of years ago called Presumptive. It was an essay where they asked me to write an essay about how one might turn the 2016 campaign into a novel. And I was game for not writing fiction about it, but for writing an essay about it. And I sort of foreclosed the possibility of ever doing that because I thought one of the candidates would have been fascinating. I mean, we've seen her in fiction before. I mean, Hillary Clinton, she's Carol Kennicott in Main Street. She's Sue Bridehead in Jude the Obscure. I mean, fascinating, conflicted, full of complexities. And then there was the other candidate who in the essay I described as... I think I said, lacking the two dimensions required even of a sociopath. I am a heartbroken, never Trump conservative, for the most part, libertarian conservative. But so it's a kind of niche pain. But I have no desire to live there. I just want to survive these years, not chronicle them. The one review of the Times review of this book, Kurt Anderson says, well, I guess we can assume that Mallon is going to do the Trump presidency in another book. And I got an email from my friend Christopher Buckley, the novelist, the son of William F. Buckley, the next day. And he said, don't you dare. He said, I'm 23,000 words in. And my working title is Make Russia Great Again.
Nathan, if you had to write about somebody you've reviled, have you written about somebody you've reviled? Or
no,
that's why would you?
Yeah. No. I was going to say, this sounds like a Beverly Hillbilly mashup. I was actually thinking for the Trump thing. That one. I'd rather watch it as a show.
Yeah. Hi, thanks to both of you for such wonderful readings. This is a question for Tom Mallon. You know, you were talking about the difference between being a historian and writing historical fiction. And it occurred to me that one of the advantages of writing historical fiction is that you think your way into the times in a different way from the way a historian does. And I'm wondering, since you managed to work your way into three particularly embarrassing and catastrophic moments in modern American history, whether you have any insight into why we continually repeat this pattern.
I think if I did, I would have gone into politics instead of literature. I mean, not really. I'm a bad predictor of events, and retrospectively, I'm not sure any kind of straight nonfiction analysis I would give would be of much use. I mean, one of the things we were talking about this just before the program, I've gotten asked in the last couple of years a lot to compare Trump and Nixon. You know, journalists will call up and so forth. And I always get kind of cross on the phone whenever I get one of these calls. I mean, they say, well, you know, what would you say, Nixon and Trump? And I said, it's like comparing a dolphin to an amoeba. You know, I mean, Nixon was a figure of immense complexity, morally conflicted, did some awful things, had a sense of shame, though. You know, when there was talk of, we were talking about this, when there was talk of Nixon pardoning himself, just as a few months ago, there was talk of Trump pardoning himself. And I was just having an aneurysm saying to the reporter, I said, you know, but there, do you not see the difference? The idea was Nixon was going to... pardon himself, and then resign his office. Trump's people were talking about how he would pardon himself and remain in office. So the differences, I think, still strike me as greater than the similarities. And I hope this is just the greatest blip or aberration of all time on our historical timeline.
There's a question in the middle, and while we're getting there, gentlemen, I wanted to throw out a quote to you and just take your temperature on it. I don't know if you saw today's Times, Nathan. There's a review of a book by Yannick Hanel called Hold Fast Your Crown. And in it, the writer posits a definition of what a writer is. And he said, you can tell a true writer is someone whose solitude reveals a relationship with truth and who at every moment devotes himself to it, even if that moment comes out of a minor tribulation, even if that truth escapes him and seems obscure, even insane. Does that kind of describe your process in gestalt when you're writing?
No, I wish I were so elegant. You know what, I'm a super neurotic and a sufferer and everything makes me crazy. Like, I can't even tell you what pre-launch, I don't know how it is in your house. Like, my wife has to shoot me with a trank dart. It's like very, but I guess, you know, it's so bizarre to have to make statements like this about truth now. Like, this is the point. It's not old fashioned to have, like, my subject now seems to be empathy. Like, that's not like an idea. Like, it's how we function. It's the reason we have society is to, like, take care of each other. You know, this, we were like through the looking glass that, you know, writers have to make statements like, yes, I explore truth. Like, it is the human condition. But, that's a more... Now I want to drop a whiteboard. If you're asking honestly and don't come onto these stages if you're not going to be vulnerable, but I become really obsessed with dissociative states and what happens in the process. Like conscious me, like this is writer me up here and I'm being honest me up here. But like when I go into that room, you know, back to that religious childhood, there is this notion of the world falling away. So any statement about what a writer is or what they're doing or who their audience is, like you'll never read a word that I write with intent that's about truth or exploration or storytelling. I mean, you know, talking to two writers, I always feel like it's like maybe like two people with drinking problems. If I'm like, I drink a case of beer, and you're like, that doesn't sound so bad because he drinks two cases a day, you know. But I got paired many years ago at the Rubin Museum with a psychiatrist. This was not a private session, it was a group session. And it was to talk about my dreams. And I have dreams in this book, by the way, which I really thought a lot about. Jews dreaming and Jews dreaming when they're in Israel is a whole separate thing because that is a reality. I don't like dreams so much in fiction, but I was like, you know, those are true to us. But the event was to build for me to talk about my dreams. And my oldest friend I've been friends with since I'm four, she's been telling me since we're four, like, nobody wants to hear about your dreams. You know, like I was a pumpkin and then I, you know, was, anyway. But so I said, let's talk about the waking dream that is writing. And it changed my life, this like 1 hour on stage. Only this one's going to change it more, I know. But I, you know, I said, what happens? Like, it's almost like when you're riding a bicycle, you know, that feeling, like this idea, you teach your kids to ride a bicycle, you're running behind them, you're holding the seat, and then the kid sees, you know, that they can ride on their own because you stopped, and then they crash because you've betrayed them. I really think it would be so much better if kids didn't know how to ride bicycles and didn't feel betrayed. I still remember that betrayal where I was like, where, my dad's at, like, where are you? Anyway. But there's this notion, and it happens, like, there's a part of the day you work hard. Like, writing's about digging in. I know, like, people have real jobs, but nonetheless, it takes many hours. It's not about being inspired. You show up and you hammer. But there's a little part of the day, like, I catch myself sometimes, where the whole world has fallen away. You know, I'll literally... The me that's talking to you, I'll be like, Nathan, just stay in it. Like, sometimes I'm figuring something out, and I'm typing so fast, I, like, can't even, you know, finish the sentences or get it. It's really, like, a messy kind of typing. And the me that's talking to you is thinking, like, just stay calm, you'll get it. But I'm like, if I can't, like, chew gum and walk. Like, if I can have a conscious thought to stay calm, because, like, I'm like, who's typing, you know? And the psychiatrist told me, he's like, this is the age-old thing that, like, deeply religious people, the person who can hit a foul shot when there's 60,000 people booing, like meditative states. It's literally you are training your consciousness. We all daydream. We all lose consciousness, which is why you can't text and drive. Everyone's like, I can text and then drive. But that minute, you know, please only kill yourself if you're doing that. But like, it's that space in between where you lose consciousness. So for me, this is the dead serious answer. There is a sweet spot in every day where I am not, you know, and when I wake up from that, that's the writing that makes a book. So yeah, there is no intent. My intent is to reach the state of no intent.
Tom, do you want to field that one?
Well, Nathan's new book, which is wonderful. I do think novel writing is fundamentally an exercise in empathy. That's essentially what it's about, adopting a point of view other than your own when you're inside any character, trying to see things the way the character would. And one of the things I think that is wonderful about Kaddish.com is that it's overtly, it's not just an exercise in empathy, but it's overtly about empathy. So many of the conversations, whether it's between Larry and his sister, whether it's between Larry and his dead father, whether it's between the newly religious Larry and the rabbi in Israel, they're conversations about struggling to see things from the other person's point of view. They're exasperated, they're very tender conversations, wary conversations. But I think that is fundamental to the enterprise, and I think, not to beat a dead orange horse, but one of the reasons I could not undertake that novel is I just would not know, you know, forget sympathy, we're talking about empathy, I would not know how to get into that head, because for one thing, you have to, when you empathize with somebody, the end result, in theory, of the empathy is a kind of sympathy, a kind of understanding of the person. And I've been inside the heads of many unappetizing people, both fictional characters, you know, entirely made up creatures, as well as historical figures. I mean, I have written a long scene from the point of view of John Wilkes Booth. And you have to be able to, even there, it's, you know, he only just leapt over the balcony and he broke his ankle on the stage at Ford's Theater. Now he's running in the alley. God, that must hurt him. You know, you have, even John Wilkes Booth, you have to be able to feel what you think they were feeling. And so I think sort of the bonus feature of Nathan's new novel is that it practices empathy as an extremely skillful novelist would, but it's also about empathy on the surface, about the practice of empathy between very sympathetic, flawed human characters.
That's so kind. Thank you. Now you're making me think of what it is to function without shame, which I want to talk about for like 9 hours.
We had a question in the middle here.
There's a question for Mr. Englander, and it relates to the Haggadah that you worked on, and we thank you very much for that. What conversations were you hoping you would generate around the Seder table from families reading it?
That's a really, about the, yeah, Haggadah, I have to say, I'm so happy to be, you know, I've just started touring and nobody's had time, thank you for already having read it, it's been out for 9 hours, but touring with the Israel-Palestine book, those are some good audience questions, but nothing has ever been harder than touring a Haggadah. People are like, you can't, everyone, so I was like, use yours, I'm not taking them. It's not an NRA issue, like, just keep it. Anyway, but, what conversation, that's like a nice thing, back to friendships of, like, people knowing. I did not want to do that project so badly. Like, I wasn't interested. I left that world, you know, and and Jonathan really talked me into doing it. And this is so touchy-feely. That's the point. It's a vulnerable thing that we do. I can't stop thinking what you're saying about the shame thing and the Nixon. Literally in the CNN, I was watching Betsy DeVos. They took the money from Special Olympics today. That's before I was like, that you could, anyway, but that, yeah, how to write people can function without shame is an extraordinary, it's not a task. Anyway, but, you know what? I just, back to like all my touchy-feely like stuff about falling away. It's just, I just wanted to do justice. I remember what it felt like. If you speak Hebrew, that's the point. I'm so, I like my, I
launched in New York last night. My Italian translator happened to be in town in the first row, and I always call her like my voice. Like these people who get to be me in another language, and like it's so beautiful. I can sit and like in Germany, and by the way, if you want an hour reading in Germany, they're like, this event's only 4 hours. We want they can sit, you know. Anyway, but like some an actor will read for you. Sitzfleisch. Anyway, but an actor will read for you there, and I'll like sit there, and I'll be like, if I can feel the rhythms, and you know, if it's a good translation, I'll be like, everybody should laugh right about now. And then I don't speak a word, you know. Like I just said Sitzfleisch. I'll call that Yiddish. Anyway, but. So I was really thinking of that feeling as a kid, like I don't translate those things, these things that you say every year, which gets back to the chicken and the egg of writing. It's sacred time and sacred space, these routines, the saying, I used to like say mean things about my high school all the time. Now I say nicer things. The idea that I prayed every day for like all those years for so long and they never taught us what we were saying is actually like you can hear I write to rhythm. So now I'm like to have to sing a song that you don't know what it means every day, all day long. It really helps you with rhythms. So, but I know that Haggadah stuff, like I just wanted people to feel what I, like to just know what it means to me. That's the translator's job. Like what its true meaning is, and two parts of it. The one word I'll tell you, because that really upset some people and other people embraced it, but Eloheinu, Elokeinu, like, which means like, you know, our God. Like I thought like that is so against, back to the crazy use of religion now, the absolute abuse of these books, like that anyone could be waving the Bible around in this country. It says so clearly, like, we are strangers in a strange land. Like, you not only can't close these fucking borders, like, you need to welcome, if anyone crosses, you need to welcome them to your house, you need to give them to the keys to your car. Like, that is the same Bible that they're using for all this nonsense. It's clearly written. Nonetheless, and I think it's about hubris, and I get very upset with, like, chosen people. It's like chosen to serve, and I thought, like when we say blessed, you know, our God, I was like, it's not our God that we possess. It's Elohe, it's a singular word. And I just wanted people to think what they're saying. It's God of us, like the God over us. I'm not religious, but what can I tell you? Like, I just wanted people to think about what they're saying with certain words. And those were really hard, like rhythmic changes when people are very used to saying our God. And I think about that a lot. And back to research and verisimilitude, which like, you know, I'd love to talk about. My editor said last time, I remember in the Israel novel, I like had a balcony. I felt like technically, if you're on this balcony and you're looking that way and the Knesset's there, and it's like, you can't really see a cypress tree. And she, 20 years she's working with me, she goes, I have an idea. What if we market it as a novel and then you can make some things up? But nonetheless, I really care. You can change the things that need changing. Everything else must be true. But for the Haggadah, I found this ex-Hasidic guy who does theater. He was like the perfect brain for me. He's like a true artist and truly like Lubavitcher Hasidic mind. And I said, the only way to do this is Chavruta, which is how I learned to study, which is head-to-head study. So yeah, I built it old school way for just a year. You know, back to my house, my wife's like, why can't we have a mezuzah if you can turn the house into a study hall? You're such a weirdo. Anyway, but nonetheless, yeah. I built it the old way, but for me, it was all about the feeling of thinking the thought, like, Eloheinu does not translate as our God. It's a different word. And all I wanted to do was make the feel of the Hebrew and the Aramaic that you feel if you know what it means.
Sadly, we have to leave it there. Until next time, please welcome, please thank Nathan Englander and Tom Mallon.
Thank you all for coming out.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.